The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile on Premier Christian Radio with me, Claire Musters. The Profile is brought to you in association with Premier Christianity magazine. If you'd like a free sample copy of the latest issue, you can head to our website, premierchristianity.com/free sample. So today on The Profile, I'm talking to Joe Saxton. Joe is an international speaker, a Bible teacher, and a best-selling author who has a passion for discipleship and mission. I spoke to her about the issues that are covered in her new book, The Dream of You, which looks at embracing our God-given identity.
You have a podcast with Pastor Steph, Lead Stories, and I believe you actively mentor groups of women. I've seen you do that online sometimes. I'm just wondering what you feel the place of mentoring has in discipleship, and whether you think the church does it well or not, and why you do your own initiatives.
Yeah, I mean, I think mentoring is an absolute game changer at the best of times. But I think particularly if you feel called to leadership, and particularly if you're a woman, because you don't often see people who are doing what you're doing. And I think when you, there's a woman here called Marion Wright Edelman who leads, I think she leads something called the Children's Defence Fund. And she said this line in relation to kids, but applies to women too: you can't be what you can't see. And I think often if we don't see other examples, living examples of people doing what we feel called to, we're not going to try. Because all the questions, the issue of skill is almost down at the bottom of the list compared to how do I make it work? Is it okay? Have I got permission? Will anybody believe me? Is it too arrogant to want it? And all those other questions. I mean, I've been mentored by men and women, and I've always found them be quite transformative in terms of me embracing what I was called to do, having the courage to do something about it, and being accountable about it as well. So in terms of the groups I mentor and stuff, I didn't feel really particularly strongly about mentoring women until I was here in the States. And I think probably because in the UK, there wasn't, at least at the time when I was still living there, there wasn't a kind of women's ministry stuff. I know like Colour and that are there now, but there wasn't a women's ministry thing as such. And in the environment I was in, I saw men and women leading, but it felt so much more pronounced here in the US. And I had a lot of people just ask me. I think maybe I'd got to an age and stage where people were just saying, you know, how did you get to do that? And what did you do? And how did it work? And it forced me to think about it and to almost not take for granted the things that I've been given. And I'd always done it one-on-one, but what I find in groups is that you kind of rise together. You mentor people together and you build a network and almost like a sisterhood of relationships. So I've done lots of initiatives on the side and not on the quiet as such, but just getting on with it and getting on with it ways of trying to gather women leaders together and affirm them and help equip them where possible, invest in them where possible, help build their confidence so that they can be unleashed. Because I get tired of, now this is probably rude, Anyway, I get tired of people asking, where are the women? You know, where are the women who are speaking? Where are the women who... And I get asked it in both the US and the UK, and there's no reason for either. Just look harder. You know, it's actually not that hard. It really isn't. You find them. Yeah. And if you don't, ask someone and they'll tell you. You know, it's not that hard. But equally, I've often found that difficult is because sometimes women leaders find it harder to articulate what they want and the opportunity, particularly in the area of wanting opportunities, because ambition isn't always seen as feminine. So it's been great to gather leaders together for those reasons, to help process things like that.
And some of your previous books have been for leaders, for women, but your new book, The Dream of You, is very much a personal story. You do divulge a lot of detail about your own life. Why did you think now was the time to do that?
It's funny, you know, because I didn't actually realise quite how much I'd said about myself until later. I was a bit slow on this. And I thought, oh dear, it's there. I mean, I think, again, because it was the nature of the topic, because it's a lot to do with framing, how we frame our identity and how our identity gets to where we are. I asked the question, who were you before anybody told you who you were supposed to be? And it always gives people pause, men and women of every ethnicity that I've had this conversation with. It always gives us pause because we know there are so many internal and external factors that have shaped us. And it felt weird to write about that without talking about my own life. Yeah. In that, I think when you're going in tender places, and it's something I've learned and continue to learn as a leader, when you're wanting people to go to tender places, you've got to be willing to model that in some way and be transparent in some way and vulnerable in some way. And so it felt important to do the same. And I think also because otherwise it's really, or at least I found it very easy in the past to make platitudes of things of identity and say, well, my identity is in Christ. And it's like, that's great. And it's true. It absolutely is. It's just that if you don't say how you got there, no one, I remember people saying things like, that's great information, but I don't know what that means. I don't know what that means in practice. And maybe not being from an entirely church background has helped me ask more questions on things like that.
You talk about your childhood a lot. You talk about the fact that you are the child of Nigerian immigrants in the UK. But you also talk about the fact that you were placed in foster care and you're placed into a white family. What sort of effect do you think that had on your identity at an early age?
Well, yeah, my foster mother was very normal. And she and she was very good. I mean, I'm so grateful to the Lord for her. And she was very good in terms of she never asked me to assimilate. She always celebrated our culture. And so I didn't have to fit in. She learned how to do my hair. She learned what my skin needed. She learned all those things and never made it weird, which was great. I think it was probably weird to some of the neighborhood. that was weird. And so I think the impact it had on the identity wasn't so much being with a white family, but how people reacted to me and my brother being with a white family. Because it was the 70s and racism was more explicit. It's not that it's gone away. In fact, it seems to be making a wonderful comeback. But at that point, it was real explicit. So I think the impact on my identity was it was very clear. We belonged in terms of as family and as community. We didn't belong in terms of everybody knew something was different about us. And so that was always pointed out, sometimes out of curiosity, sometimes aggressively, sometimes negatively. And those things definitely impacted my identity.
What about the moment where you travelled back to London for what you thought was a Christmas visit and then you say, and then you realise you were there for good? I mean, how did that make you feel about your identity?
You know, to be honest, I mean, and it's typical, isn't it? At the time, it was just like, I think the best way to describe it is happy, sad, because your family's your family, but your family's your family, and they were all my family. Yeah. And that wasn't a disconnect for me because I've never had a nuclear family. Nigerians don't do nuclear. We do extended. So it's always been very natural to have an extended family. And it wasn't like this dramatic kind of, oh, my gosh, I've been taken from these people. It was like, I'm with my family. But what about the rest of my family? Because, you know, because you're five. And it probably wasn't until I was way older that I actually thought of the ramifications of how easy it was for me to detach from relationships. Now, that definitely, but at the time it was weird and didn't make sense and great and difficult and painful and confusing all at the same time.
Well, it's interesting what you say about your foster mother really embracing all the different things from your heritage, because that obviously helped you. You do talk about that talk that your aunt gave you, which I wanted to bring up, with the fact that because you were black and a woman that you'd have so much more to contend with. And what kind of effect did that have on you?
Now, the irony is, I think that's probably had the biggest impact. The biggest impact. It was 81, so it was just around the time there were riots in Brixton, which is about 3 miles from where I lived. And you'd see things on the news, which were your neighbourhood, which weren't but it wasn't described in the way that you knew. And people describing places and people groups in ways that weren't familiar to the people you knew and what we did when we were in Brixton on a Saturday in the market and stuff. And I remember at the time when my aunt said it that time, but I mean, we had that talk repeatedly through my childhood, repeatedly. It was like just a very, very common conversation. And I don't know many people of colour who haven't had the talk, to be honest. I think I've met one in my life. And it was very much a sense of this is what it takes to survive in this world. This is what it takes to overcome the stereotypes. This is what it takes to overcome the systemic and habitual stereotypes on account of gender and accounts of your race. And I think what it did was make me think, well, if I want to succeed, I mean, the talk was, Joe, to make it, you're going to have to be at least twice as good. And so it made me, it was the tools to fight with in many ways, that to be twice as good was the only way through, or at least to try to be twice as good. And it wasn't that I was competing to be better than anybody else in many levels. I was competing to not get left behind. And so there was a fundamental difference for me in that I wasn't trying to put anybody else down because I was already down. I was already bottom of the rung. And the thing is, it wasn't just that the talk shaped my identity. It was that it was reinforced on a regular basis in the world in which I lived. you know, it was reinforced in the ways that we were spoken to. It was reinforced in the way that we were followed around stores. It was reinforced in certain things that you'd see in the popular culture about Black people or about women, about expectations of women and things that the expectation of Africans, you know, the amount of jokes that went around about African Nigerian princes who are doing scams and all these other sorts of things. And the reinforcement of all of those things make you think, well, okay, then what does it take to get taken seriously for simply who you are, to not be tolerated, but celebrated for who you are, and all of those things. And so I think it certainly made me driven. I think I was probably already driven. It just gave me a lot to be driven about. And because it's something that's in the culture around you. So on one level, you can heal up all you want. The world hasn't changed. And so you have to keep on coming back to the Lord about how you process that.
You said you had difficulties accepting God as your father, and that caused you to kind of just work twice as hard for acceptance, etc. So you obviously have got all these different factors. So how did you come to the place of really truly understanding him as your father then?
Yeah, I mean, I think the drivenness was just the modus operandi at that point. I guess the attitude was, if you want anything, that's what it takes. And I mean, in terms of coming to the understanding, I would say God came to me. I didn't get there. I was very clueless. And it was years, I mean, it was 1990, it was at St. Mark's Church in Kennington. And someone had given a prophetic word, basically, about somebody not knowing who their father was. And it just undid me. I mean, I was there to hit on a guy, to be blunt. But it undid me, because, not that it was a prophetic word, completely used to that. That had been my church experience anyway. It was that God was talking to me, and that he saw fit in amongst a few hundred people to highlight my life. And it wasn't that even I felt special. I felt known. And I felt known and seen. And I think I felt a lot of life, either through my own personal circumstances or the circumstances of the culture, not being seen for who I was and therefore not being valued. Yeah. And it was this moment where the King of Kings said, I see you. He said, I see you. I see your story. I see your pain. I see your history. I see your grief. And I see how you've gotten on with it. And it matters to me. It matters to me that you've been through this. And it just undid so much junk. But even after that, there's been an ongoing process of getting to know God as my father for years. It took years, because those things that they didn't arrive immediately, so they don't go immediately. You know, it's like change from glory to glory and all that stuff. It was, God's been so gracious to me, but I think on that one, I didn't do it. He's just been very persistent in helping me understand. Very persistent.
And you've already talked about this like a little bit earlier, about the fact that it's only in Christ that we find out who we truly are. But actually, you are very honest in your book, and you say quite a lot of us haven't found ourselves in Jesus. And why do you think that is?
I think because sometimes, although we sing and pray and read about Jesus reaching to us, I think sometimes our default position is what we do to reach to him. And so we forget that we can draw near to God with full assurance of faith and find mercy and grace. It's like, okay, God, here I am for you. I'm going to present my faith to you. I'm going to perform my faith for you. And I think that's what happens. And I think some of us forget that being in Christ is part of this covenant exchange where he takes on our junk. Maybe we're embarrassed or ashamed of our junk. So it's like, I'll clean it up. You don't worry about it, Jesus. I'll clean up and then I'll come to you. And when I'm better and when I'm a bit healthier and I prayed more recently, then we can talk. And it's amazing how easy it is to slip back into those old groups.
Yeah, absolutely. But I also think sometimes it's actually, we don't want to be open about our junk, because it's really, it can be really costly. You talk about that too. You're very honest about the process and say, yes, we experience relief and freedom, but actually sometimes when God's doing a deep work, it really hurts. It's really painful. And sometimes we actually just want to hide away and comfort ourselves rather than facing that. So how did you learn to push through in those moments where you had that choice of, do I do this or do I just hide and comfort myself again?
Yeah, I mean, I think pain's a great teacher one way or another. Do you know what I mean? Whether it's the healing pain of being vulnerable or the damage. And I think there are a couple of things. I think I learned maybe the first time God met me, probably that time when he revealed himself as Father, I just thought, I'm going to take a chance on God on some of this stuff. You know, I'm going to take a chance on him. I'm going to take a chance on him. I mean, it does sound like arrogant posturing saying that because it's God and everything, but there's no point lying to you. And I was like, God, I'm going to see if you can do something with this. And as I've seen him move, it's helped me trust him with the other things. And it's helped me recognize, you know, that his power, you know, those words where it says about his power being made perfect in our weakness came alive in a particular way. I know it speaks to a deliberate context, but in the sense of that weakness and vulnerability and God meeting me there, I've seen him do that. I've seen him take those horrible things and turn them around. So when I'm resistant, I look and think, I could stay where I am, or I could choose, yes, the picking up my cross and denying myself and admitting my junk, but following Jesus somewhere and seeing what he can do. And I think for those of us who are standing on the precipice of this stuff, I would just say, you know, you've got to take a risk on him. It is vulnerable, but I don't want to buy into the lies that tears are weak, because that's foolishness. I don't want to buy into the lie that vulnerability is a sign of you being weirdly damaged. Of course I'm damaged. I've lived life like we all have. I don't want to buy into the lies that me just covering up all my junk is the way to cope, when actually he gives us pathways to life. And sometimes those pathways have taken me to an altar. And sometimes those pathways have taken me to an altar, which also had a doctor's office involved. And I just don't need to be ashamed of that. I just want to be free. Who cares what people think when you're free, you care less. I've noticed. Do you know what I mean? It's like, we can have a conversation about whether I'm a mess for seeing the counselor, or we can just celebrate the fact that I'm free. And I like freedom. Freedom tastes way better than the other stuff.
So you talk about walking away from experiences that named you or labeled you, mm-hmm. but walking away with a limp, like Jacob. So it made you aware of your weaknesses and your vulnerability. And I mean, you've just talked about vulnerability there, that created dependence on God for you. But so many of us, and this is something that I've found over the years, we're afraid to be vulnerable with one another. Yeah. But that means not only do we miss out on journeying together more deeply, but we miss out on that intimacy with God. So why do you think we choose protection of ourselves over vulnerability?
I mean, who wants to go first? Do you know what I mean? Who wants to go first and say, hey, I'm still working through an eating disorder? Hey, do you know what I mean? Who wants to go first and say, hey, I cut myself today? Or, hey, I've lost my job and it's my fault. And all our reasons are very, very human and very, very understandable. And you know, sometimes, you know, we have been vulnerable and it's been taken for granted, or it's been taken advantage of or abused in some way. And so we protect ourselves because we got hurt. And it's hard that the same instruments of hurt as in human beings can also be the instruments of our healing, other human beings, or even the same one. And so it's, I think it just is really risky territory to dare to go there. But I also feel like, you know, our God and his very nature is relational. Jesus, who modeled a perfect life, was relational and vulnerable with the people around him when he weeps before them and he asks them to stay with him a while in Gethsemane and stuff. So he models for us a way to live. But it is costly. It really is. And again, I don't know how we do any of these things without the risk that it could go awry.
So just to go back to your own journey, and obviously we've kind of left that where you were still growing up in the UK at this point, but obviously you got married and there was a moment where you and your husband decided to move to America. Mm-hmm. And so you share about that wilderness moment. So you've moved from England to Arizona and it was a real wilderness. It was not what you were expecting at all.
At all.
The wilderness is often, the purpose behind that is testing our sense of identity and purpose and exposing the state of our hearts. You also mentioned the valley that you found yourself lamenting deeply within. So what did you learn about yourself in both the wilderness and the valley times?
Gosh, you know, the wilderness was, oh man, it was hard. And it was long. I mean, it was long. It was probably about a decade. I learned a lot about the Lord. I learned that he was there and he was faithful and he was kind. I think in many ways, I felt sometimes I was on the outside looking at myself, on the outside looking in. I think with the wilderness, it stripped things away, but it actually made it quite simple again. You know what I mean? It made it quite simple to when I was a kid in this small church that no one heard of or cared about. And I had the Lord and he was moving by the power of his spirit. And I had a Bible. And I had some friends and we were working out imperfectly and God was doing stuff. And I was reminded of that. I was surprised how much I drew on that period of my life. I thought I would draw on the big church, big experience as I'd had when I was in Sheffield and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't. I drew on the times when I was small and vulnerable and lonely in those times. And I realized that whether times were good or bad, I know how to dig for a well. Do you know what I mean? I know how to dig for water in tough times. I realized afresh the importance of praying. I think it did hit home, actually, how key it is to deal with the stuff in your life again. And that's one of my friends describes it as it's like pulling off the layers of an onion, and it's like there was a whole other layer. And some things creep up imperceptibly. You don't realize they're what you want. Like, you know, when I moved to the States, I mean, I felt called to the States. I felt called to the States since I was 14 years old. It was a long-term thing, but there was my calling which had to fall off and what God was actually asking of me. You know what I mean? I didn't know the expectations that I'd placed on things until they weren't there, until they weren't met in any way whatsoever. And I think the wilderness has a way of doing that for you. Things that you just thought that would be the way you thought they would be. And then you'll realize God never actually said that, and he never promised that. And, you know, the word promises all kinds of stuff without it being that. I think that in terms of the grief time, oh my gosh. I mean, it was devastating. It was just devastating. And it's, you know, I probably even wasn't even able to really reflect on it for about 5 years after, because it in losing my foster mother and my father in such a short space of time, like 5 weeks apart, it was just like, boom, numb. And I think looking back, I realized how much the Lord carried me. You know what I mean? He just held me. And there's a bit in the Bible, like, oh, forgive me, I can't remember where it was. I think it's in one of Peter's letters, and it talks about being kept by the power of God. Mm-hmm. And I think I learned those things about being kept by the power of God. And also that those things, you know, the wilderness and the valley aren't all terrible either. You know, I had my kids in that time. It was a wonderful time. That Arizona is this arid, dry place that if you don't drink water fast, it does mess you up. But it's also this beautiful place, a big, bright blue skies and amazing sunsets. Valleys are desperate places, but they're really intimate with God as well. And so whilst they kind of seared my soul in a way, and I'm not the kind of person who said I wouldn't change them for the world, I totally would change them. I would, if I could avoid them, particularly the valley. I'd have the people back in a shot. I'd change it. But equally, I was reminded that God is still here. He's still here. He's never left. He's never going to leave, and he's never going to forsake me. And it was never about a job or a role or all those sorts of things. It wasn't even about a country. It was about how faithful and good he was, and he still is.
So now you're obviously a very regular speaker, an author, a leadership coach. How did you get to the point of embracing this part of your life where your calling is now? Did somebody speak that into you and call it out of you? Or was it something that you very much felt for years was inside you that God had very definitely told you about, and so you stepped into it? How did that actually come about?
Probably bits of both, you know. I think some of it, I do feel clear. I do feel I'm often the last to know these things, you know, like on the leadership stuff. I look back and I realise that even since I was at school, people were putting me in positions of leadership. And I'm like, oh, yeah, right. OK, yeah, that's right. And I always considered it something that I did, but I didn't think about it in a calling sense. But there were times when sometimes just people's encouragements were really key. I remember when I was in my 20s, when I was at St. Thomas's, and the team were just so encouraging, and they gave me opportunities and they created opportunities for me, and then kind of let me in them and stuff. I think that was really affirming. And sometimes when I'd step out and try something and just see what God did, and I'm like, oh, we need to talk about what you just did there, Lord. Do you want me, is this a thing that we're going to do? Is this kind of you and me? Is this how we roll? I'll do that. And then, you know, now I think about it, there was at the end of that valley in that year when two of my parents passed, there was a moment near the end of that year. And I can't remember who, it might have been a conversation me and my husband had. There was a common, but there was something about that year at the end of it that I came out thinking, okay, I need to go for this now. And I don't know what it was. I think there was something about a generation having passed and me recognizing, I mean, it felt very young to lose people. I was 34 when they died, but there was something in that era as well that was I can't even describe what it was, but there was a moment in that year, even in the valley, of standing up again meant I was going to take hold of all that God had taken hold of for me. To be honest, I think I ask him regularly. I'm like, what are we doing? What are we doing? Lord, and trying to respond to the world around me. Because, you know, there have been some chapters of my life where I'm doing stuff, but the emphasis is very different. And this just seems to be the emphasis right now. I'll tell you what the other key thing was. I grew up a Methodist. Well, I say Methodist. It was Methodist with a splash of Vineyard, I think would be the accurate. but we used to do the Methodist Covenant Prayer at the start of every year. And there's this thing about... I'm no longer my own, but yours. Rank me with whom you will. Put me, I'm getting this wrong. Put me to what you want. And it says, let me be employed for you or laid aside for you. I'm raised up for you, brought low for you. Forgive me, Methodists, because I've completely butchered all of that. But you know what I'm saying. And but there was this sense of, this year is yours. Do what you want with me in it. And I feel, I come back to that. Right now, it seems to be that raising up leaders, investing in leaders, particularly those who are underrepresented, which often leads me towards women and always leads me towards people of color, seems to be the primary thing that gets me going. Not the exclusive thing, but the thing in this chapter of my life feels right to do. But hey, there'll be another chapter and he'll ask for something else. It's never quite what I think, but yeah, it always feels like I wondered what took me so long to work it out.
So the subtitle of your book is Let Go of Broken Identities and Live the Life That You Were Made For. So and just kind of wrapping this up, what would you want to say to readers or listeners about how they can embrace the life that they were made for?
I think the first thing I'd say is it's not too late for a new beginning. This is not for you in your 20s. I was just hearing the story of a woman in her 70s just last week who said that it's given her a fresh lease on how she perceives her life, which is really humbling and wonderful to hear. I would say we're not too far from the grace of God. We're not too far. It's not too late. You're not too far gone. You're not too lost. It's not too hard for him. Obviously, it feels way too hard for us, but it's not too hard for him. And it's worth doing. We have been given this precious gift of life. He came that we might have life and have it to the full. Let's have the life he has for us rather than the one that life has told us we have to have. And it is painful and it is challenging and it may mean you see a therapist. You know, do you know what I mean? It might. It might mean part of your journey means you need to go to a doctor and say, I have been in a weird place for years. Could you help me out here? It may mean all of those things, but underneath are the everlasting arms. And he'll lead you to freedom, lead you into purpose. And I think we need that right now. Our key relationships need that right now. Our world needs that right now. I'd say choose redemption. Choose redemption.
Everyone's favourite satirist Adrian Plass pens a new sacred diary for the latest edition of Premier Christianity magazine with his unique take on the phenomenon of the Christian festival. Plus, we ask, how should believers respond to identity politics? Is smoking the cardinal sin it's often made out to be? Hugh Ross tells how astrophysics brought him face to face with the Creator, and we bring you a special report on the megachurch movement in the USA, going behind the scenes of six of America's biggest churches. All that plus much more. Ask for your free edition at premierchristianity.com/freesample.
The Profile. You're listening to Premier Christian Radio.
Hello and welcome to The Profile here on Premier Christian Radio with me, Sam Hales. The Profile is brought to you in association with the magazine that I edit. It's the UK's leading Christian magazine, Premier Christianity. If you would like a free sample copy of the latest issue, you can head to our website, premierchristianity.com/freesample, and there you will find more interviews, features, news, columnists, and more, all from a Christian perspective. But today, here on The Profile, this is the show where we like to dig into a person's life, faith, and testimony. I'm delighted to say that I'm speaking to Tom Reed. Tom is an international singer-songwriter and producer based in Oxford, UK. He's written and collaborated with many Western and Asian artists, as well as performing and releasing his own music. He was previously based in Hong Kong, but now resides in Oxford, and his latest project is titled Lament. And he joins me now in the studio. Tom, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
We always like to start off here on The Profile by asking about a person's early life. Tell me a bit about life growing up for you.
Well, I was born in the UK. I don't remember too much up until the age of 6, which is when I moved to Hong Kong. And that's kind of like where my memories begin. So my dad is an engineer and got transferred over to Hong Kong. And this was before 97. So this is when Hong Kong was still a British colony. And grew up there, had an amazing experience, just, you know, people from all over the world kind of living in this crazy city. And yeah, I lived there for most of my life, actually. Met my wife there. I have two kids that were born there. And then, yeah, now living here, obviously. Yeah. So.
And that was all a Christian background, was it?
Yeah. So my parents, you know, I was raised in a Christian household and always went to church. And a lot of people, when they find out I grew up in Hong Kong, presume that we moved there as missionaries. But actually, we didn't. My dad's an engineer. But he did end up pastoring a church. And that's, I ended up working for that right. church as well, yeah, for a number of years.
And today you will do Christian music and you'll do stuff that isn't explicitly Christian. Has that kind of always been where you've sat? You've wanted to do both and not get pigeonholed into one or the other?
Yeah, I think I've never really sat comfortably in boxes. I want to make music that everyone can listen to, not just only a certain person of a certain type of faith or belief or whatever. So had my foot in one side and the other side for as long as I can really remember. Although I did have quite a long period of really heavily involved in like church music and worship music and producing that, you know, church albums and things like that.
Does that play in a little bit with your background in Hong Kong? You talk about it being sort of a diverse mixed place. Has that kind of fed into your music in any way and wanting to do lots of different things and, as you say, not be boxed in?
I think it probably does. You know, because there's not one overriding culture. When you grow up in perhaps somewhere where there is a strong culture from that place, perhaps it's easier to fit into something. Whereas I think I'm probably what you'd describe as a third culture kid. I think identity is always a bit of a struggle. It's like, am I British? Am I international? What part of me is Hong Kong? You know, so
according to the bio on your website, you're international. Is the word that you've used.
Yeah, I think that probably best explains it, because although, you know, obviously I am British and I live here now, I still feel like there's a huge part of my identity from living overseas and being raised in a city where, you know, there were people literally from all over the world that I caught some of my best friends.
Yeah.
And so it does influence you, and you do pull from different, you know, different cultures and things like that.
Tell me a little bit about the Hong Kong church, both sort of capital C church, what the general cross-denomination picture is like in Hong Kong, and also about your own specific church background. What could we relate to as predominantly British people that's kind of the same in Hong Kong, and what's completely different?
I think that there's quite a lot of similarities, to be honest. From my background, I was part of an international church, so it wasn't a denominational church, but I'd say it was sort of like a hybrid of, let's say, HDB and Hillsong. Mm-hmm. You know, if you kind of mix those two things together, a little bit of Vineyard in there maybe as well. And I think that was quite a beautiful thing, actually, because I like to think that you pull perhaps the best of each of those into what you're doing as a church. But I think a lot of international churches would probably fit in that mold. There's not strong denominational ties with a lot of the international churches, simply because people come from so many different backgrounds and denominations that it's kind of like what I said before, it's hard to have one overriding identity or denomination. And so it's just easier to say we're a multi-denominational church.
And presumably Hong Kong is a completely different picture to China, because when people hear China, they think the persecuted church, the underground church, real hardship. Presumably it's a different picture in Hong Kong?
Yeah, I mean, traditionally Hong Kong has had freedom of religion, freedom of practice religion, and there's been no restrictions. So that's carried on over since it was under British rule. And it's been, you know, widely respected in the culture. I do think that in recent times, from what I can gather, that there is some more influence from the mainland China coming in. And certainly, if not directly impacting on church, indirectly having an influence. That's one to watch out for.
So tell me, what brought you back to the UK?
Long story short, I had worked as a worship director for 12 years and kind of felt like it would be good to take a year off, take a sabbatical, go somewhere different and just have a year of break from ministry, or at least from ministry of the role I was doing. So we decided to come to the UK for a year. and really enjoyed that year and have ended up being here for 5 years.
The 1 year turned into five.
Exactly, yeah. It wasn't something we planned. We genuinely thought it would be 1 year, but I suppose God had other plans for us.
Was that an easy transition adjustment?
I think it was, because we only thought it was going to be 1 year. So when we were leaving, we didn't have a particularly big emotional response. Yeah, because it wasn't like, oh, we're never coming back, we're leaving for good. So it made leaving quite easy. So yeah, it wasn't too hard, although, you know, we certainly do miss a lot of our life back in Hong Kong.
What are the big things you miss, apart from people?
Hot weather, which is an obvious one. I think, you know, definitely when you grow up somewhere, you have just that strong community of people that you've known for a long time. And that's so hard to replace, you know. I think it's one of those vital things. And so we've definitely missed that. All our family live there as well. But I think even just in church, you know, I was on leadership of my church and had been involved sort of from its inception. And I definitely feel like, in a way, coming to the UK was almost like starting over again. Mm. Where no one really knows you or what you do or who you are.
Yeah, people talk about this a lot. When you move churches, often there is no kind of system where the other church can kind of vouch for you almost.
Yeah,
you know what I mean?
Here's his credentials. Yeah. So, no, totally.
You just start brand new with a brand new group of people who don't know your abilities, your giftings, your experience.
Yeah, I think it's, in many ways, particularly if you are quite heavily involved in doing something or leading something, it can be quite a humbling experience, you know, because as you say, like, no one knows or particularly cares what you did before. And so I think overall that's been a good process for me.
I want to talk about your new project. You've written many songs. As I say, both those people may know from the kind of the worship world, and those with other artists. You're working with other artists, producing, recording music. But your latest solo project is called Lament.
Yeah.
Why is it called Lament?
I think it's a topic that's been on my heart and in my thoughts for a while. I think for a few years I've been raising the question of why the church struggles so much with lament, why we don't really see it in our worship. You know, I'd written these songs that kind of all fit in that kind of idea, and so I thought, well, why don't I just put my money where my mouth is and actually just title the project Lament, you know, and really just go for it.
Was this born out of any personal experience for yourself?
Yeah, I think over the last 5 years, there's been a number of things. I mean, even the process of, like I've just mentioned, of leaving Hong Kong and leaving our safety. I think leaving my role in the church that I had, I've sort of been deconstructing my faith a little bit and my background. And so I think there was a little bit of lament going through that as well. As well as my mum, who struggled for a few years with dementia and Alzheimer's, passed away 2 years ago. So obviously there was the grieving process there, and that's fed into some of these songs. And I think lastly, I've had a sort of a lifelong struggle with anxiety and just that mental health issues. And I think that's also fed into these songs and my worship, because it can be hard times when you're in worship settings and you're not really able to relate to much of the words that are up on the screens that you're supposed to sing. So I think just a combination of those things together has kind of brought me to this place where I feel like I've been able to authentically write music that means something for me and expresses kind of how I feel.
I've heard a lot of people talk along similar lines about the kind of lack of lamenting that happens in our corporate worship. I remember even Bono, the lead singer of U2, said, worship leaders, why don't you write a song about your bad marriage, or write a song about something that isn't going so well in your life, and kind of bring that to God in a worship sense. So you hear people, even people like Bono, talking about this, and yet you look at the songs that are being written and being sung, and there doesn't seem to be a huge amount of change. So what's happened there? Because it's not like people aren't pointing this out. And yet, at some level, the well-known worship leaders who write songs don't appear to be writing about this.
I mean, I think there's so many reasons, but probably the main reason is it's just not attractive to, you know, I'll be honest, like, it's much easier to write a song that makes people feel good rather than a song that makes people perhaps question or have to think about hard things. That doesn't mean that one is any better than the other or of more benefit or less benefit. It's just, it's a lot easier to write songs. And most church leaders that I've ever spoken to are really quite afraid of the idea of lament, because they think that it's going to be depressing, you know, and quite rightly, they don't want people, I suppose, to come to church and think like, what a depressing place, you know. But I think that all comes down to the misunderstanding of what lament actually is and what it means and what it could be and should be in a church context.
Yeah, you can understand that because, like you say, people don't go to church to be depressed. So what is the answer to that? How do you write a song about lament that doesn't just depress people? Or are you saying there is a case for depressing moments in a church service?
I think depressing is the wrong word. I think that's the misconception, this idea that lament is somehow going to make everyone feel bad. And I think it couldn't be further from the truth, actually. For me, what lament means is it really just means being honest and being real, and allowing our worship to talk about issues that are real and honest. You know, I think that when we do that and we allow for that, for the most part, people appreciate that. Just if you look in, if you take the, you know, counseling or something like that, or the grieving process. The grieving process is something that is vital in order to allow humans to move on with their lives. And, you know, it's known that if you sort of ignore the grieving process or like try to avoid it, it can lead later on to other problems. And I think lament's the same thing. It's just the idea that we shouldn't avoid the hard things in our lives. We shouldn't avoid the hard questions, or we really should just acknowledge that, okay, things aren't great right now. It doesn't mean that they're going to be that way forever. But to be real, I need to say, I'm struggling right now. And I think that it is a really hard thing to do. It's a tricky thing to do corporately, because not everyone's going to be feeling that way.
Yeah.
And I think that's always the big argument that comes out. Well, why do we need to talk about that if not everyone's feeling that way? But obviously, when you flip the question on its head and say, well, what about the people who aren't feeling happy, and we're singing songs that about being happy and victorious, you know, but that seems to be okay because we want to make people feel good. And I think to do that, you're doing a disservice to the process of lament, which actually is allowing people to acknowledge so that they can move on, so that they can reach that place of hope, so that they can reach that place where healing begins in their life.
I mentioned a moment ago that worship leaders don't tend to write songs like this. Now, there are notable exceptions. I can think of the Tim Hughes song, I've Had Questions Without Answers. Mm. But, you know, a lot of those songs, they do take you then to a place of praise, and they take you to a place of, I will still trust you, I will still love you. Mm. Is that the kind of corporate lament where actually it takes you on a journey and it doesn't just lament, but it brings you to a place of praising in the pain? Is that the idea?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's where that's how we most often see... that's the closest thing we see to lament in our worship that we have. You know, you have songs like Blessed Be Your Name, for example, that do talk about it. But I think one of the things that perhaps we always tend to do, which I'm not sure is a good thing, is we like to wrap things up nicely. So it's like, it's okay to say this is hard, but as long as we say, you know, the good thing. And I think true lament, it's like this thing where, you know, when someone's grieving, and it's easy to always use grieving examples, I think it's most helpful. Probably one of the least helpful things to say to someone grieving is, oh, well, God has a reason, or God, you know, there's a reason, God has a plan. Or even if that's the truth, it's not necessarily helpful to the person in that moment. Yeah. And I think lament's the same. I don't think it's about taking people to this dark place and leaving them there. I think it's acknowledgement. If you acknowledge, I think, you know, I always try, if you look at the songs on this EP, I do feel like it's a hopeful EP at the end of the day. You know, I don't feel like it's depressing or it leaves people going, oh, you know, what's the point? I think that the real idea of lament is that there is hope and it's okay. Like for me, I think that all of my lament is allowing myself to say, you know, God, this is really hard and I don't understand and where are you? But the point is, I'm still saying it to God. I haven't like walked away, or I haven't detached myself. It's my cry to God. And I think that's the powerful thing, is that we are coming before God. And that's the worship, you know, is that's what God asks us to do in the scriptures, bring before him our lament and, you know, these kind of things. And so I think that, you know, we don't necessarily need to wrap things up neatly all the time, but I do think we do need to say, I'm going to trust you. Mm. You know, it's like the answer's not there yet, but I'm going to try and trust you.
Are you hoping some of the songs on this EP, Laments, will find their way into congregational worship?
I didn't write the songs with that in mind. I just tried to write the most truest songs and genuine expression that I could. Obviously, if there are songs that that churches feel like would benefit them, then I'd love that. And, you know, we have done some things like we're doing some acoustic versions of the songs and putting the chord charts up and making the sort of tracks available to people so they can use them in their church worship. But it's not what I was really shooting for.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
Yeah.
You used a really interesting phrase a moment ago. You talked about you've been deconstructing your faith.
Mm.
And I hear, typically, actually, younger people use this phrase quite a lot at the moment. There seems to be this idea of deconstructing, taking everything apart, looking at it all, and then maybe putting it back together, but in a slightly different way to how it was before, which I know many people will be thinking that sounds a bit vague. So do you want to talk a bit more about what that actually means for you? What does deconstructing your faith look like?
Yeah, I think, I mean, I grew up in an evangelical church, and I think that there's so many things I'm grateful for, and so many things that have shaped my faith, which, you know, have stayed with me. But I think perhaps one of the things that has not been so beneficial is this sort of idea in evangelical Christianity that everything is just completely sure, like assured, and there's no doubt. There's no questions. It's like, you know, the Bible is 100% everything it says it is, and you have to take it at its face value. And I think that that's how I kind of was raised. That's kind of the Christianity that I was raised into. Anything of the world is bad. You know, I remember my youth pastor taking all my secular CDs, and we went up to the roof and we snapped them and broke them and like burned them because they were all evil, you know. And I think that the problem with that kind of, I would say, fundamentalist almost viewpoint is that when you get to your age that I'm at now in the 30s, I look back and I think, you know what? I'm not so sure anymore. Like, I still believe in God, but I'm not so sure on like all these things that I thought were like absolutes, you know? And so I think deconstructing is allowing yourself to go back and look at perhaps some of the things that you were taught and go, oh, what do I think about that? And you might come out the other end and go, ah, yeah, I believe that. Or you might come out the other end and go, I'm not sure if that's what I believe or not. But it's kind of the idea that you're allowing yourself to ask more questions and to look back on perhaps some of the things you were taught in youth group and see actually are they where you stand now.
You mentioned that part of this new project is came about through your own mental health problems with anxiety. Where's the sort of line between that and faith? Because I've spoken to people before who've said actually the kind of church attitude towards this mental health problem has been really, really awful. You know, you even hear stories of people saying, well, someone tried to cast a demon out of me because I had depression and those sorts of things. I mean, I don't know if that's your experience, but what has been your experience with having mental health difficulties and how that relates to your faith and your church background?
Yeah. And I think that's great because that's a perfect example of one of the areas of faith that I've deconstructed. Because when I was growing up, I was told so many times that was all, you know, anything that was depression or anxiety was all demonic and needed to just be prayed away, you know. And so I can't tell you the number of times that I've prayed for God to remove my anxiety disorder and stop me having panic attacks. And, you know, you just get to a point where it's like, well, clearly that prayer is not being answered. I think it's a misunderstanding of, you know, kind of just almost like how it works, you know, and that we can't just pray every bad thing away. And I think with mental health especially, yeah, the church hasn't been great in acknowledging that we actually do need help that's not just spiritual help, but we actually need professional help in this area and being okay. So this idea that, you know, you're somehow, it's somehow you don't have enough faith if you rely on medication or need to have medication or counselling or whatever. I think those attitudes have been so dangerous in the past. And it's great that now we're at a place in the church where we're actually saying, no, they work hand in hand, you know, and it's not one or the other. But pray into those areas and have people pray for you. But at the same time, get the help that you need, you know.
Mm. It seems like attitudes have changed or are changing in that respect. I mean, I'm sure there used to be attitudes around physical healing in other ways, like if you had a bad leg, that some people might want to attribute that immediately to a dark spiritual realm, whereas now most people won't, and they will talk about, well, you can go to the doctor and have prayer. Are we now moving into a time where most Christians will say it, you know, your mental health is the same as your outward physical health in other areas? It can be prayer, it can be a doctor, and it can be a combination.
Yeah, I would hope so. I think, and it's not just the church, to be fair, I think this is a happening across society, where we are now gaining a better understanding of mental health issues. And that can only be a good thing, because I think people have suffered for so long feeling like, you know, there's something wrong with them and not being able to or not feeling comfortable getting the help that they need. So I think it's great that we're starting to see that, but obviously there's still a ways that we can go as well. Yeah.
You're now based at St Aldate's Church in Oxford, have been for the last few years.
Yeah.
So tell me about how that came about and what you're involved in there.
Well, Aldate's is my local church. And one of the other areas where I was deconstructing my faith, just this idea of one of the things that troubled me slightly about modern evangelical church, particularly with mega churches and things like this, is the kind of like the grounding, I suppose, of perhaps, you know, one of the things that I suppose attracted me to the Anglican Church is the history of the Anglican Church and the tradition of it and the practices that have been practiced for centuries.
Mm-hmm.
And I think there's something really special in that that is missing from a lot of, you know, when we throw out a lot of stuff in the modern church, we're actually throwing out a lot of tried and true practices that have sustained Christians for, you know, centuries. And so I've really enjoyed being at Aldate's, where I feel like there's a good mix of tradition and modern. It's an Anglican church and still follows some of the liturgies and obviously has this rich history dating back almost 1,000 years. You know, I just think it's amazing when you stand in a church and you're worshipping and you look up on the wall and there's like a sort of plaque that says, you know, John Smith worshipped here from 1647 to, you know, 1700. You think, that's incredible that I'm standing in the same place worshipping the same God as people who've done the same for like hundreds of years. And I think that there's something really powerful in that.
When it comes to worship leading now, how does that whole thing look different on the other side of something like deconstruction? Has the whole worship world been part of that deconstruction?
Yeah, a little bit. And I would say that this new Lament EP that I've done is part of that. It's part of allowing myself to not just write songs that I think the church wants to hear, but actually writing songs that I think perhaps people need to hear, even if they're not as embraced. You know, so it's very tempting to write a song that you know is just easily going to be sung in church and is going to use the right Christian words and phrases that are guaranteed to get people to get their hands up in the air, you know. It's very tempting to do that because it feels good and it makes everyone think you've written an amazing song. And obviously, like, there are lots of amazing songs. I mean, I think my biggest thing is I just want to advocate for more variety and a bigger, like, width of songs in the church, rather than perhaps the kind of narrow ones that we have come, where it's like everything is sort of quite victorious and kind of is driven to that sort of emotional response. But I love to see songs that really make you think, you know. Is it a bad thing if we go away from a worship time going, oh, that lyric that we sung in that song, what do I think about that? Surely, like, that's a good thing when we're making people think harder about the things that they're singing. It's not just so comfortable that they've heard a million times before. So yeah, I've definitely I feel like I've definitely been looking and deconstructing that kind of side of things, not to criticize anyone or anything. I think that, you know, the song, like I said, the church needs so many different types of songs, and that's what I hope to see.
We said earlier, you know, you've been involved in music across the board, not just in Christian circles. Is it difficult to make a living from music?
Yeah, I think it is. I think that, you know, people who are in the music industry, particularly artists that are trying to make a living, are some of the hardest working people you'll ever see. It's not like the old days where people bought music. And I think particularly in the UK as well, if you're a Christian artist, it's even more difficult because generally there isn't much of a sort of Christian music scene or industry here.
No, and it's incredible how that's changed, actually. So back in the sort of 90s, early noughties, I can remember there was a kind of scene where church youth groups often would invite Christian bands in, whether it was Delirious or The Band With No Name or The Tribe or all of these different people. And worship leading was kind of a part of that as well. Tim Hughes or whoever would turn up in your church. And that seems to have kind of gone.
Yeah.
I don't know what happened there.
Well, I mean, I don't know either. I could hazard a guess of a few things, particularly from people that I've talked to or artists that I know about. A lot of the talent that we would have seen in the church from before are now doing it outside of the church. And I think a large part of that reason is because they're not being as valued within the church. You know, the church hasn't placed as high a value on Christian art or art in general. Mm-hmm. You know, if it's functional, great. If it's leading people to Jesus, then they want it. But if it's just, you know, someone really expressing their art and being real and honest, it's not as embraced. And I think that a lot of the true and really good sort of artists that are Christians are now doing a lot of stuff outside the church and in the mainstream because it's more readily accepted and embraced there. And I think that's definitely something that the church can look at, you know, and say, you know, is there a place where we can, you know, foster the arts and creativity more within what we do?
Mm. That's a wonderful place to leave it. Tom Reed, thank you so much for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
Weight loss solutions are not one size fits all. Hers makes it simpler to get started and stick with a weight loss plan backed by expert guided online care that puts your weight loss goals first. These include oral medication kits or compounded GLP-1 injections. Through Hers, pricing for oral medication kits start at just $69 a month for a 10-month plan when paid in full upfront. No hidden fees, no membership fees. You shouldn't have to go out of your way to feel like yourself. Hers brings expert care straight to you with 100% online access to personalized treatment plans that put your goals first. Reach your weight loss goals with help through Hers. Get started at forhers.com/foryou to access affordable, doctor-trusted weight loss plans. That's forhers.com/foryou, forhers.com/foryou. Paid for by Hims and Hers Health. Weight loss by Hers is not available everywhere. Compounded products are not FDA approved or verified for safety, effectiveness, or quality. Prescription required. Restrictions at forhers.com. Apply.